Support for this public radio podcast comes from Mellon Financial Corporation, helping financially successful individuals and families protect and maximize their assets through the practice of wealth management. Mellon.com. And by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Try as they might, investors can't turn back the clock. So when they look at all the big stock indices and the records being set, it's not quite a fair comparison because markets change over time. The S&P 500 toyed with a record high close today, didn't quite get there, but even so, people are real excited. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Reuters, the world's news and information source, working to make a difference every day. Before it's news, it's Reuters. Science and technology reports are supported by Boston Scientific, committed to delivering what's next in medical technology to help clinicians improve and extend lives. BostonScientific.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you with us. Today's Wednesday, the 23rd of May, which makes it 7 years, 1 month, and 29 days since the S&P hit its record high. 1,527.46 was the close that day. Investors were oh so close once again today, just as they have been all week, missed by about 5 points. When people talk about the broader market, the S&P 500 is one of the things they're talking about. A lot of analysts see it as the most accurate snapshot of what's going on. But what they're seeing now, both in the index and the whole stock market, is very different than the last time Wall Street was posting these kinds of numbers. Marketplace's Elisa Roth explains.
Back in 2000, information technology was the biggest sector in the S&P 500 index by far. About a third of the stocks represented were IT companies. Today, it's fewer than half that, only about 15%. Energy companies are much better represented than they were before, and they're helping lead the rally, even though they were the laggards 7 years ago. So is it even fair to set today's record against the last one? Peter Buchvar is an equity strategist at Miller Tabak.
It's truly not apples to apples, but it's, I guess, the best that we have. I think the point is that the companies that are in are still representative of similar sectors that existed 7 years ago or 10 years ago or whatever.
In any case, he says, it's not so important what stocks are pushing the S&P up. What counts is whether the market as a whole keeps doing well. Richard Sparks is an equities analyst at Schaefer's Investment Research. He says today's markets have little in common with those heady old days.
It's not an over-the-top bullish rally that we're seeing like we did back in 99 and 2000 when people were buying anything that wasn't nailed down and people were buying hand over fist with no discrimination. You know, they were buying companies that had no earnings to speak of.
Between 1995 and 2000, the S&P more than tripled. It hasn't even doubled since the current rally began around 4 years ago. Sparks says that's because today's investors are much more tentative, and that, he says, is a good thing. Deliberate investors could keep the rally going. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
For those out there who are curious, the Nasdaq's still about half its all-time record. Remember the minimum wage increase, the one that was passed by both the House and the Senate and then never went anywhere? Well, it's going somewhere after all, right into the Iraq War funding bill that's probably going to pass. But that, in turn, is putting some of the more liberal members of the Democratic Party in a bind, because now, if they want to raise the minimum wage, they're going to have to vote for the war. Jeremy Hobson reports from Washington.
Democrats had to give up timetables for troop withdrawal in the agreement reached yesterday on the war supplemental, but they did get $17 billion in domestic spending and the first minimum wage increase in 10 years, from $5.15 an hour to $7.25. That wasn't a good enough trade for Liberal Democrat Dennis Kucinich, who called it minimum wage for maximum blood. Faz Shakir at the Center for American Progress agrees.
I don't think that it's right at this stage for anybody on the left who's been opposed to the current course in Iraq to say that this is somehow a victory.
Indeed, Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi has said she's not likely to vote for the war funding. But does this mean key Democrats will be voting against minimum wage? In the House, they've got an out. They'll vote on two separate amendments, one on war funding, where they can vote no if so inclined, one on domestic spending and the minimum wage. Thomas Mann is with the Brookings Institution.
This gives them an opportunity to demonstrate how they feel about each part of it, and that's what members are looking for.
Democrats in the Senate won't have it so easy. It'll be an up or down vote on the entire package, domestic spending and war spending, all in one. Norm Ornstein at the American Enterprise Institute says lawmakers often find themselves in these sticky situations.
You probably are voting for something, even though you don't like a part of it, but then being stuck with the part of it you don't like.
The House could vote as early as tomorrow. The Senate plans to get it done before the Memorial Day break. In Washington, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
We mentioned gas prices on the program earlier this week and how they're at an all-time record high as well, just like the stock market. That is a fact that hasn't escaped congressional scrutiny. The House passed a bill today that would make gasoline price gouging a felony. Penalties would run $150 million for companies, $2 million and 10 years in jail for individuals. One catch, though, just as the House was voting, an expert from the Federal Trade Commission was telling the Senate there's no evidence illegal business practices are, in fact, sending gas prices up. Crude oil closed up about a quarter at $65.77 a barrel in New York today. That's an item of note to the U.S. oil industry, even the parts of it that aren't based in this country anymore. Halliburton's the world's biggest oil field services company. This week, it officially opened its new headquarters in Dubai, and it sent out a call for local investors. Marketplace's Jill Barshay has that story.
Halliburton wants a Middle East investor to buy a large stake in its oil services business. It may even list its shares on the Dubai Stock Exchange. Middle Eastern oil fields are drying up. Halliburton specializes in getting the most from old wells and helping to drill new ones. The Middle East is expected to be Halliburton's fastest-growing market. Matt Simmons is chairman of Simmons & Company International. That's a Texas investment bank that specializes in the energy sector.
As oil fields decline, you need to exponentially increase your rate of basically drilling wells and providing services. So you know, maturing oil is basically a blessing for service companies.
Halliburton plans to pump billions of dollars into the Middle East over the next 5 years. It's already hired thousands of local engineers and workers. Halliburton doesn't need money from Middle Eastern sheikhs, but it wants to be known as an international company. Brad Handler is a senior equity research analyst at Wachovia Capital Markets. He follows energy services companies like Halliburton.
Because of its successes in some of its core businesses in the United States, it has a bit more of a shift to make than some of its large peers.
Halliburton started that shift in April when it shed its military contracting unit, KBR. And last Saturday, Chief Executive David Lazar opened a second headquarters in Dubai. He'll be splitting his time between Dubai and Houston. In Los Angeles, I'm Jill Barshay for Marketplace.
A 5.5-year legal battle over insurance payouts for the September 11th attacks came to an end today. New York Governor Eliot Spitzer made the announcement. Seven companies will pay $2 billion total. That's on top of about $2.5 billion they've already paid. Best guesses are it'll take $9 billion in all to rebuild at ground zero. Investors did a full-on Greenspan fade right about lunchtime today. The former Fed chairman said he's worried about a sharp drop in Chinese stocks at some point. Wall Street took that to mean right now. Cost him the gains for the day. I don't know, maybe they were flashing back to the last time Chinese markets took a dive back at the end of February. We'll have the details on all of that when we do the numbers. The Commerce Department releases new home sales figures tomorrow, but today a Treasury Department official gave a slap on the wrist to the lenders that finance those sales. John Dugans, the controller of the currency, that makes him the chief bank regulator in this country. Dugans said today mortgage lenders aren't verifying the incomes of the people they're lending to. He said too often banks rely on what borrowers claim they make rather than checking to make sure the numbers add up. When those numbers don't make sense, borrowers can't pay their loans and their homes wind up back with the lenders. Those lenders want to get their money out as soon as possible, and one way to do that is at auction. We sent Marketplace's Jane Lindholm to check out the bidding.
If you've ever been to a cattle auction, you'd be well prepared for a housing auction. Except instead of discussing hoof quality and bloodline, it's all about square footage, bathrooms, and garages.
All right, number 34 in the brochure, folks. This is a 39859 Chippewa Circle in Murrieta. It's a four-bedroom, two-and-a-half bath. It's $219,000 starting bid. Here we go.
Here we go, 219. Here we go, 219, 225, 250.
At the Riverside Convention Center, an hour outside of Los Angeles, about 1,000 people with brochures and paddles sit in folding chairs as the bidding starts. On a big screen is a picture of a two-story house with a market value of $420,000. 2 minutes later,
last call for $300,000, $290,000, now $300,000, and the bid said $300,000, and I have sold that $290,000, subject to confirmation.
All right, property.
The 98 houses at this auction have gone through foreclosure and are being sold by the lenders who now hold the titles. Auctions like this are happening more frequently these days as the number of foreclosures is rising. DataQuick is a real estate information services company. It says about 37,000 foreclosures were completed last month nationwide. That's more than double last year's figures. Places like Nevada, Florida, Michigan, and California are especially hard hit. Rob Friedman is the chairman of Real Estate Disposition Corporation. His company runs housing auctions, and he says business is booming.
Basically, this is a counter-cyclical real estate business that when the market is down is when we're busy. Fortunately or unfortunately, and we envision a lot more business in the next year, year and a half.
That looks like a safe bet. There was a surge in home loans right around 2 years ago, and now that the real estate market is softening, many homeowners are defaulting. But big lending institutions are worried about depreciation, maintenance costs, and vandalism. So Friedman says they're willing to sell these homes the quick and dirty way, at auction.
You know, the guys don't want these properties back, I can assure you of that. They're willing to give a value today. They don't want the properties back.
Savvy bargain hunters can get quite a deal. At this auction, Regina Lane had the winning bid on a three-bedroom house near Palm Springs. It was valued at $399,000. She got it for $260,000.
It's exciting. I just can't wait to get into it, because I haven't seen it. That's the scary part.
Michelle Williams Court says Lane should be scared. She's the director of litigation at Betzedek Legal Services in Los Angeles. She deals exclusively with foreclosure issues.
Most individuals who are purchasing properties at these sales don't know the history of the property that they're purchasing. So they could be not only purchasing a home, but purchasing a lawsuit as well.
Williams Court says buyers at auctions risk losing their houses down the line if the former homeowners sue to get their homes back and win. She says the whole process is just too rushed. The auctioneers partner with lenders and escrow agents who set up shop right at the auction. Buyers can get a loan within an hour and keys to their new houses within a week.
I think it streamlines things, but I think it streamlines things in a dangerous way. It also has the effect of preventing someone who's purchasing a home from really thinking about the consequences of what they're doing.
Rob Friedman, who runs the auction, says buyers can and should prepare.
The key to being successful at an auction and the key to getting a good value for your family is to come prepared, do your homework.
He says as long as buyers inspect the property, know what the house is worth, and what they're willing to spend before they bid, auctions are a great way to get a good house cheap. And a little due diligence on the part of a buyer can prevent that home from going back up on the block. In Riverside, California, I'm Jane Lindholm for Marketplace.
If you want to see what a housing auction looks like, Jane took some pictures out at Riverside. They're at our website. It's marketplace.org. You know, it's not just the S&P and the Dow. Records are being broken all over the place this week. Everything from the Russell 1000 to the Wilshire 5000 are in uncharted territory. To look around Wall Street, you'd think we were back in the days before anybody knew what a dot-com bust was. Commentator Ben Stein says all that investor enthusiasm's misplaced.
There's a wonderfully sad movie from Italy called The Garden of the Finzi Continis. It's about a rich Jewish family in Italy as the Nazis take over. The family lives lavishly in their garden inside their walls as if nothing bad were going on outside, until one day the Nazis storm in and the wealthy Jewish family is sent to the gas chambers. In a way, the stock market in America recently reminds me of the garden of the Finzi Continis. We're inside the walls of our beloved America watching money grow and lining up for Bentleys. But outside, out in that terrifying place called the outside world, disasters not only lurk, but are sometimes happening right now. We're not winning the war on terrorism. Al-Qaeda has resurged in Afghanistan, along with their pals, the Taliban. The collapse of order in Iraq is beyond words. Now it's reported that Al-Qaeda has control over some of Iraq's oil, and therefore virtually unlimited revenues for their wickedness. Scary. Pakistan is ruled shakily by a man who befriends the U.S. and at the same time cozies up to the Taliban. Saudi Arabia, world's largest owner of oil reserves, is beset by Iran and by internal subversion. Venezuela is ruled by an actual psychopath who would love to use his oil to bring us to our knees. Yet almost every day the stock market soars, as if all of these terrible facts were happening in another universe far, far away. 9/11 should have told us we're all in the same very dangerous world, and it's getting a lot more dangerous every day. If there's a bad terrorist incident blocking the flow of oil, oil prices surge and the economy is in peril. If there's a big terrorist incident anywhere, interest rates shoot up and the economy slows drastically. This is what the terrorists are planning, and their plans often work. Why is the stock market celebrating? Our walls are mighty thin, and what's outside them does not wish us well.
Ben Stein is an actor and a writer. He's a lawyer and an economist, too. Send us your thoughts when you get a chance. Our website is marketplace.org. Coming up, not far from the Garden of Eden, the apple makes a symbolic return.
These farmers, if they continue to lose money on their apples, at certain point in time, they will desert these lands and this whole industry.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials fell 14 points today, about a tenth of 1%, to close at 13,525. The Nasdaq slipped 10 points, about 0.4%, to finish at 2577. The S&P 500 declined a single point, a tenth of 1%, to end at 1522. Canada's aluminum giant Alcan shot up 6%. The firm's top brass yesterday recommended shareholders reject a takeover bid by American rival Alcoa. Alcoa advanced 3.2% today. The Times of London reports Alcan is talking with Australian minerals company BHP Billiton about a possible rival bid. BHP Billiton bounced up nearly 2% today. Payless Shoe Source said it would buy StrideRite for $800 million. Payless skipped up 10%. StrideRite stepped up more than 30%. In other retail, Target, the nation's second-largest discount chain, climbed almost 1%. The company said cost-cutting boosted its net income. There was also high customer demand for electronics and prescription drugs. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Want to know what's in the works at Marketplace? How about getting the latest news and features in an email? Sign up for the Marketplace Midday Update. It will keep you up to date on the day's business news and let you know what to expect on our next program. Go to marketplace.org and click on the newsletter link on the right.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events on Thursday. Irish voters go to the polls to elect a new prime minister. The Commerce Department releases new home sales figures for April. And the Hay on Wye Festival starts in Wales. The literary event is sponsored by the Guardian newspaper and attracts tens of thousands of people from all over the world. It's been dubbed the Woodstock of the Mind. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizadal.
I'm going to sit right down and write myself a letter.
Mostly what we get are emails, not actual letters, but we're not going to get hung up on a technicality here. You know, for all the work they do, somehow it seems unfair that mothers get only one day a year where they're the center of attention. Earlier this month, commentator Nancy Olesen talked about being a mother for a second time, caring for her niece and nephew after her sister fell ill. It's tough work, she said, but also the most important job there is. Penelope Floor from Moss Beach, California, couldn't have agreed more, but she wants to remind us there are other people out there doing that job, too.
Thousands of child care workers also care for other people's children. They are doing this hard and important work for less money than parking lot attendants earn. More often than not, without medical insurance benefits and with no 401k plans to ease their retirement.
Some companies are beginning to include socially conscious agendas on their business plans. The idea is that instead of concentrating only on making money for their shareholders, they'll make it their mission to invest in ethical causes. They're known as B corporations, B being the benefits in social benefits. We aired a report on a group of entrepreneurs that are developing a new standard for that kind of operation. Kim Bruno from Washington, D.C. says that's all well and good, but ethical practices ought to start from the top down.
Instead of mandating that corporations consider long-term issues such as environmental cost, it would be better to measure executive performance against broad benchmarks. Has the executive properly judged how to grow the enterprise by responding to global warming, to an aging workforce? Those are the goals that will build long-term shareholder value.
A correction now, or a semi-correction anyway. Maybe it's a clarification, I don't know. Last week we aired a story asking whether former Fed Chairman Alan Greenspan is stealing Ben Bernanke's thunder, what with all the publicity that Greenspan's been getting. We compared Greenspan to Babe Ruth, and Bernanke to the nameless, forgotten guy who batted after the Babe. Who knew we had so many baseball fans in the audience? Plenty of you knew exactly who that guy was, and you pointed out that our analogy was a little flawed. Andrew Mertens from Durham, New Hampshire.
First, Greenspan, whatever his strengths, was no Babe Ruth. Second, Bernanke has a long way to go to merit comparison to the guy who batted after Ruth. Fellow named Lou Gehrig, and yes, a lot of us do remember him, even if we did not have the opportunity to see him play the game.
And finally this, in our coverage of Chrysler being sold to a private equity group last week, we referred to the U.S. automaker's German parent as Daimler Chrysler. We got a complaint or two about the pronunciation, saying it ought to be Daimler. So we checked.
Thank you for calling the Daimler Chrysler Corporation. Please.
It's radio, you know, so pronunciation's important to us. That's it for this time. If you have any comments or corrections or complaints, go to our website. It's marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. There are a couple of places in the world where international borders are seriously fortified and notoriously difficult to pass through. The demilitarized zone between North and South Korea is one of them. The border between Israel and Syria along the Golan Heights is another. The two countries haven't had diplomatic relations since Israel occupied the Heights after the 1967 war. And the border fence is guarded by soldiers from both sides as well as a special unit of the United Nations. But this year, for the third year in a row, the gates at the Kunitra checkpoint have been opening several times a day, as Orly Halpern reports.
The gate is just open, and the truck driver is about to cross into Syria, up here in the Golan Heights on the border with Israel.
Yeah, we just came to transfer apples from Israeli side to Syrian side. After that, then we go home.
That's Joseph Machiri. He's a truck driver. But his black skin and his non-Arabic accent reveal that he's no local. He's from Kenya. So why bring Joseph 2,300 miles to drive a load of apples 200 yards? Because this business deal is taking place between enemy states whose residents can't enter each other's territory. Oded Ratner is responsible for fruit in the Israeli Ministry of Agriculture.
4 years ago, if somebody would come to me and would say, we are going to sell apples to Syria, I'm sure I will think he's mad. It was unbelievable.
But sometimes economic pressures can get people to do the impossible. Druze on the Golan used to make their living from apples. But as the Israeli apple market got flooded with apples, the prices dropped. Asad Safadi, a Druze from the Golan Heights, manages East Cold Storage, where apples get cleaned and stored.
Although in Syria there are a lot of apples, they don't need apples. But they made this gesture for us because they believe the Golan Heights is a Syrian land, so they are committed to help the people here.
Israeli farmers were equally interested in getting their government to agree. But as Ratner explained, the government had to find an almost Talmudic way to get around political and military restrictions to allow the Druze to trade with a sworn enemy.
One is the finance minister, which had to give us a special license to deal with the enemy. The other one is the Ministry of Defense, which had to give the army the order to cooperate because the fruit is passing through a military point.
So why did the Red Cross, a humanitarian organization, get involved in an apple deal? To get the apples to the other side. Mohammed Safadi, the representative of the Red Cross in the Golan Heights, helped arrange the deal. But it wasn't an easy sell.
In the beginning, Geneva, which was our headquarter, kind of almost refused it. Some people viewed it as a business-like type of activity. Actually, we looked at it as in the long term that these farmers, if they continue to lose money on their apples, at certain point in time, they will desert these lands. And this whole industry will not be sustainable. And at this stage, we might be required to provide them with assistance.
Rima Ramia is packing apples at his cold storage and is happy the apples are going to Syria.
We are not happy when our apples go to Israel. We are Arabs. We want our apples to go to our people.
This is the land of many false starts, but hopes are high that the trade between enemies will continue. For now, they are packing apples. In the Israeli-occupied Syrian Golan Heights, this is Orly Halpern for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Fox Searchlight Pictures, presenting Waitress, a comedy about a diner waitress who finds inspiration in motherhood, friendship, and pies, in select theaters now. And by Putnam Investments, where a well-thought-out allocation strategy can strengthen your portfolio. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note, hedge funds invest in everything from toll bridges to movies. Now one firm is backing a more worthy cause. Gotham Capital has teamed up with medical researchers to offer $1 million prize for cancer research. Dr. Gary Curhan of Harvard Medical School says the Gotham Prize is designed to foster innovation in a field where it's been lacking.
We're not making as much progress in preventing and diagnosing and treating cancer. And myself, along with the other co-founders of the Gotham Prize for Cancer Research, felt that we needed to take a new approach.
He points out federal funding has been relatively flat in recent years, and that's a challenge for researchers writing grant proposals to finance their work. He did say it doesn't just have to be professionals who enter the contest. Dr. Curhan said anybody who's got a good idea is welcome to try it out. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow dropped 14 points, a tenth of 1%. The Nasdaq lost 10 points, about 0.4%. The S&P 500 slipped a point, more than a tenth of 1%. Our engineers include Ravi Karman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Eric Johnson, and Joel Stein. If you happen to miss the program on the radio, try our podcast. The podcast link is on our homepage. It's marketplace.org. Next time, does Britain's latest visitor attraction have a ghost of a chance?
Who are you? Ask me who I was.
Who were you then?
In life, I was your partner, Jacob Marley.
It's Dickens' world, believe it or not. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.